Good morning, everyone. We're going to get started. I'm going to do a brief introduction of the introducer because I'm sure a lot of people know Toby Shelley, but I just wanted to share with you a little bit of information about him, who served in the military for 30 years in both the United States Air Force and the New York Air National Guard. He retired from the Onondaga Sheriff's Department Police Division in 2011, and he resides now in Atisco, where he manages a cattle farm that has been in his family for 200 years. I know. He's also a volunteer for the Atisco Fire Department, and I invite him to the podium to introduce Lieutenant Colonel Kilgore.
Good morning. And thank you. I didn't expect that warm introduction. So as a 30-year military veteran, as she mentioned, and as an Iraqi war veteran, it's my honor and my pleasure to introduce Colonel Michelle Kilgore. Colonel Kilgore started her career in the Air Force as a Air Force Academy graduate, graduating in 1992. She has circled the globe in various bases, from California to Hawaii to Korea, to Alaska, of course, Afghanistan and Iraq. She has flown multiple aircraft from KC-10s. She's a, 3,500-hour pilot, 3,500 hours predominantly in KC-10 tankers, refueling other aircraft in the air. She also flew Navy aircraft. I saw the E-6 on there, and I'd like to hear that story, how you get from an Air Force tanker to a Navy E-6. And then she moved on to F-16 fighter Falcons, which we had here in Syracuse for years. And that's very interesting to fly tankers, Navy aircraft, and fighter aircraft. And there's other aircraft, training aircraft, and C-12 is in there as well, small, that transports people around. So that's interesting. She has been involved, been deployed 7 times to various operations from Northern Comfort. Is it Southern Comfort? Which is it? Both comforts, north and south in Iraq. Deployed in Operation Iraqi Freedom, which I was involved in. And she's involved in both missions in Afghanistan. They changed names and we started to leave, and the current one's still going on. So 7 times deployed. She's currently the commander of the Reapers we have at the 174th Fighter Wing. You know, the base is kind of divided into different groups. One group takes care of the facilities, the buildings, and the grounds. One group repairs the aircraft and trains them and things like that, and the other group flies them, and she's in charge of the group that flies those aircraft. The colonel is a defender of our country, and she's a fighter for our freedom, and I'd like to welcome her to speak.
Oh, good morning. So thank you very much for having me this morning. Great job from memory. I do not have a cattle farm, so I do not have that cool factor that he has. But I have a very interesting career path that you don't see these days in the Air Force. And it definitely, telling my story, kind of relays how our national defense strategy has changed over the last 25 years. When you look at the Air Force I joined, and then the unit I lead today, and how vastly different they are. So going back a little bit to the beginning of that story, so I joined the Air Force in 1988, 5 days after graduating from high school, and it was the Cold War. So we are talking about the Eastern Bloc, Europe, Russia, all of our tankers and our strategic bombers on alert, nuclear war. That was the Air Force I joined. All my classmates were studying strategic languages such as Russian, Chinese, and most of our majors at the academy were engineering or political science, things that were all part of our national defense strategy that we thought we needed. When I was a junior, and back in 1990-91, that's when the Berlin Wall fell down. And then now we're like, well, now what are we going to do, right? Now we're all out of a job. Here we are. I'm a junior at the academy. What am I going to do with the rest of my life now that I have no job? So shortly thereafter, we had Desert Shield, Desert Storm. And from then on, you know, we've basically been the entire rest of my career, we've been involved some way in the Middle East. So graduated pilot training at Columbus Air Force Base in Mississippi. And I am so old that women could not fly fighters when I graduated from training. So I went off to fly the KC-10 at March Air Force Base, California. So join the world, you know, join the Air Force to see the world. I'm from San Diego, and where do I get stationed? Right back at home. The one base that I can get to. So I'm like, here we go. So I go to KC-10s at March Air Force Base, and I do a couple deployments there. They close that base, which is a bit of a theme in my career. And so they move the entire base to Travis Air Force Base up in Northern California. So can't get much further away from home, but I'm still in the same state, you know, trying to see the world. So by then, the rules have changed, and they do allow women to fly fighters, but now I'm flying KC-10s. So I had some great mentors and some great leaders, and they said, well, you need to go get an assignment somewhere so you can apply for this job and be competitive. So you need to go somewhere that's smaller than the state of California. So I took a tour flying C-12s in Korea, in South Korea. So I went to South Korea, a small unit, and our job there was to fly the Korean diplomats, the Air Force generals. I got to fly the chief of staff. I got to do a lot of really interesting political missions on the ongoing issues with Korea. For those of you who are history buffs, you'll know that the Korean War, we're at a standstill. The war actually has never ended. So there's continuing ongoing talks all the time between North and South Korea. And I've been able to visit the DMZ there. And if you've never visited a communist country, it's an interesting experience all by itself. So I did a year in Korea, inter-theater airlift, so twin-engine prop airplane. By then, I had applied and I got picked up to fly the F-16. So I left Korea, went to Arizona. At least now I'm finally getting further away from home. And I spend my year in Arizona learning to fly the F-16, and I get stationed in Japan. So I go out to Japan. Again, this is all pre-9/11. So, you know, by now the Air Force, we're starting to do rotations all around the world. Hey, you know, we're the world's peacekeeping force. We're going to do some presence. And I go off. I'm a big adventure enthusiast, so I go off to Africa to climb Kilimanjaro, and I come back and 9/11 happens. So we were already scheduled to go on our regular theater deployment to Turkey to do overwatch in Iraq, which had been going on since 1991. So the night before we get on the airplane to go to Iraq, 9/11 happens here, which is 9 o'clock over there. We get on the airplane, we still go, but they won't let us fly over the Middle East, so we have to fly the long way around the world to get to Turkey. So we leave Japan, we fly over the United States, we fly through Europe, and we go all the way back to Turkey because we couldn't go through the Middle East to get there. So I spend 4 months in Turkey as not all of our operations kicked off in Afghanistan, which is Enduring Freedom, which is still ongoing, and came back from that. After everything I just told you, the Air Force decides you need to career broaden because apparently flying KC-10s and C-12s and F-16s is not a broad enough career because there's a pyramid somewhere that everyone must match on their career progression. I'm like, but I've already done all this. And they say, no, you must career broaden. I'm like, all right, that's how I got to the Navy. So I picked up a tour flying EA-6s in Seattle, Washington. And I did that for 3 years. Got to deploy back to Japan. So I'm a bit of a Pacific Theater buff now by trade. And spent a tour over there. And so I found myself on deployment with the Marines, flying a Navy aircraft as an Air Force pilot. And I'm thinking, what did I get myself into? This is not the Air Force that I joined. From there, started to make some life decisions about, hey, where do I want to, I'm still single at the time. What do I want to do with my life? What do I want to be when I grow up? And that's when I came to the Guard. So I called the unit out here. Anyone ever been out to 174th besides? Oh, awesome. Okay, so our wing commander is about to retire this weekend, and 10 years ago he hired me when he was the deputy of operations. So I called him up on the phone and said, I'm getting out of the active duty Air Force, and can I have a job, please? And he said, you know, sure, love to have you. So I've been out here at Hancock ever since. I called out here in 2003, and I've been serving ever since, and I do love my job. With the F-16s, we went to Iraq twice. We went to Balad for 2 more deployments, And then in 2010, we transitioned to the MQ-9 Reaper. For those who aren't familiar, the MQ-9 Reaper, we have the schoolhouse. We do all the training for pilots and sensor operators. We also do all of the maintenance training for the same mission. We do launch and recovery here, as well as we own all of the range complex up at Adirondack, as well as Fort Drum. So a very busy organization that I lead, and it is a privilege to lead all of those citizen soldiers who live in your communities. My group has 291 military personnel, 36 contractors, and we put through over 100 students annually who go off to other bases once trained. So a huge operation. It is no longer your grandfather's guard, where we come to drill weekend and we do our 1 weekend a month and our 2 weeks a year, and we watch football and eat pizza and wings, and we wait for the active duty to call us up to go do something that is very important. We have people out there every day. We're on 24/7 missions, as well as running two full-time schoolhouses. So the mission of the Guard has changed significantly since I joined the Air Force back in 1988. What you see now is all of our forces are very operational, no longer strategic, and that matches what's going on in the Air Force in terms of the war on terror, terrorism, violent military extremism, things that we can no longer contain, things that we can no longer do like we did with the Cold War in terms of deterrence. As anyone who watches the news, as soon as we think we have a handle on it, we have another Boston Marathon, we have another Brussels, we have another suicide bomber. So that's what's going on in the Guard. The Guard has a threefold mission. We are the nation's war fighters. We augment everyone who's on active duty. We have our domestic mission, and then we're all part of the partnership program with our local communities. So our domestic mission is probably one that's the least known or least observed. And that's what, when 9/11 happened, we had F-16s flying over New York, and we did that for months and months. When Buffalo got their 7 feet of snow, we send all of our heavy equipment operators, we send all of our manual labor, we drive out there, we put generators up, we shovel homes out, we help clear roads. When dams break, we go and we fill sandbags, we provide, that security presence of just being there. We have mobile command trailers that can set up radios when all the power's out. So we have a lot of that we do in on the domestic side that most people don't realize. If you've ever been down to New York City, you will see military personnel walking around with all of the New York Police Department down in Times Square. That's called Empire Shield. And again, that's a presence to give the public some security that there is a military presence down there. On the partnership side, besides doing things like this and bringing our story to the community, all of our people who belong, only a third of them are full-time. The other two-thirds of our base are part-time, meaning they have another job. They are only there in some capacity part of the time. So we have doctors, we have lawyers, we have judges, we have students, we have stay-at-home moms, we have business owners, we have airline pilots. And so we have people who want to serve, but they have another job in life. They want to wear the uniform, but they have other aspirations. So that's an interesting mix when you talk about how to work all of those schedules in. I have a hard enough time managing two children, a spouse, and one job. I don't need to be throwing four more jobs in there on top of that, especially for our people who travel the world with their jobs and their businesses. So it's very interesting when this weekend happens to be drill and all 291 people are present. The stories around the table for us are very different than it was on active duty, where we're all doing the same thing. We come to work at the same time, and we all have basically the same experiences. Now I've got firemen, I've got police officers, I've got trauma surgeons, and we're all doing the same thing, sitting in the same meeting, getting our weekly brief on self-aid buddy care and everything that we're required to do for the Air Force. So that's kind of what the Guard has become, and it's a very, very exciting time for us to be in the Guard because we're very busy, and we see what's going to happen as a new president takes over and see what happens on the national strategic landscape of what's going on. How am I doing on time? Perfect. Okay. I'm a fast talker. I got a lot to say and I got a lot of stories, and I want to make sure that I leave enough time to talk about what you guys want to hear rather than just hearing me ramble on and on and on. A couple other things that are going on out there. So we are the first unit to fly the MQ-9 from Hancock Field, which is a Class C airspace, which is very exciting. So you'll be seeing those out there if you haven't already. It's been on the news. And that's a big deal as the FAA and as technology advances to the point where that's where we're at. So we were the first base in the Guard to get the MQ-9, and then we were the first to fly out of Class C airspace. So that's pretty impressive. Right now, most of our training is up over the Adirondack, so it's not like the F-16. You don't have the cool factor of driving down I-90 and seeing the airplanes and hearing them. That era has gone. These are very, very quiet. If you're not sitting out there, you won't hear them take off. They're very small. So we do most of our training up over the Adirondacks. So you're not really going to see the big air power force that we once had out there. And then, like I said, this weekend we get a new boss, which is exciting for us. We have a new adjutant general in the state of New York. So we have a lot of changes going on, and I'm excited to be out there. I love my job. I love coming to work. Like I said, everyone who works for me and in my group, they're members of the community. They go to school here. Their parents go to school here. They pay taxes. They rent homes. They buy homes. You know, they travel out of here. So it's great when we talk about the citizen soldier and what we do, because everybody has a piece to that community. We recruit from our communities. I have, in my group alone, I have 15 family pairs. So I have a parent child, two siblings, two cousins, an aunt and a cousin, an aunt and a child. So, you know, we recruit. It's a very family-based organization for people who want to serve, want to wear the uniform, and be part of something bigger than themselves. So I really love what I do. I love coming to work, and I love being part of that and using my knowledge and my expertise to drive our piece of our national defense strategy. So back to my bio, you know, I do have almost 4,000 hours in about 6 different airplanes. So very unique. That career path no longer is possible. We've changed our training, the way we do training, and you can no longer jump from airplane to airplane. Military is in my blood. My grandfather was on a carrier that sank in Pearl Harbor, and he was rescued floating on a piece of the carrier, I guess, was retired before I was born. My dad is a Vietnam F-4 pilot, and so he punched out over enemy lines before I was born. I was picked up the day I was born, and so when we sit around the dinner table, we have some pretty interesting talks between Grandpa in the Navy, Dad in the Marines, granddaughter in the Air Force, who has the coolest job. So far, they win. I have not been on a carrier that sunk, and I have not been shot down over enemy lines, so I think I'm winning. But I'm very proud to serve, and I'm really proud of the heritage that we have there. So that's my basic prepared remarks, but I want to know what you guys want to talk about. And she has a microphone, and that way I can talk about what you want to hear.
I'd like to congratulate you on having broken many glass ceilings in the sky. I'm probably going to ask some of the hardest questions for me in the 50 years that I've been a member of GMR. And I'm going to start with how do you give leadership and focus to the team when they look out every month and they see protesters over the fence at Hancock? That's the beginning. And they're protesting the drone program. How do you provide that leadership and focus when the national and international people speak about the number of neighbors, people that are not in the military that are killed because of action? And how do you provide leadership and focus to a team when people doing what you do have been assigned to kill American citizens overseas, and even their children, at least in one case, who have nothing to do with the military?
Okay, that's a lot. All right, so the first part about the protesters. So our, you know, we all need to take the oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States, and that includes your right of free speech. Protesting is not new, and my dad has a lot more stories about that in Vietnam. Actually, it really doesn't bother us. That's our mission. They come out there and they do their protest, and we fight for those freedoms to allow them that opportunity to express their opinions. And honestly, it doesn't bother us. We know they're scheduled. It's happens, you know, twice a month, I believe. And we go about our business and we carry on. I would tell you that, you know, anyone who was around on 9/11 doesn't understand that. And anyone who has lost friends, neighbors, family, in 9/11 or in Afghanistan or Iraq doesn't understand why we would not want to fight the global war on terror. And so they're not really understanding why they would be doing the protest. I think the protesting comes more from a lack of understanding about the legal ramifications of what we can and can't do in the United States. People are concerned that they will be losing freedoms or that we'll be spying on them or they'll be looking in your backyard or in your windows. And that's not what we do. We train, we do aircraft handling, we train to, you know, search and rescue, we train to look for people, we train for all the same missions as manned fighters do, and as well as manned aircraft around the world. It's no different other than the fact that we're sitting in a building here rather than sitting in the airplane up in the sky. It's still an airplane, it handles like an airplane. I can't walk away from it, I have to be sitting in the seat at all times, so there's really no difference. So we believe that there's some antiquated education there about, and some fear, and people, you fear what you don't know, and so people are concerned. Hollywood doesn't help us. You know, they make some movies and make automation, and they make it seem like, you know, airplanes are going to have artificial intelligence, and they're going to take over, and they're going to go do things, and this is not like that. We do not fly armed anywhere in the state. We don't fly armed in the country. All that is overseas. So hopefully that answers the protest. But how do I motivate people? I don't have to motivate people. All they have to do is watch the news. All they have to do is watch the attack on Brussels, watch the Boston Marathon bombing, watch anything of all the horrific things that are going on in the news. Those factions of terrorists do not value human life of any sort, and they torture their own people more than they go out. They go after anybody who threatens their way of life, not just Americans. So when you look at what they do to their own people with their own suicide bombers, what we hear in the news is the attacks against Westerners. What we don't usually hear is the attacks on each other. And so when we were on the ground in Iraq, there would be more patients in our military hospital that were Iraqi civilians than there would be military members in uniform, because they had the two warring factions, and they would put a suicide bomber into a crowded marketplace, which is all women and children, let off a suicide bomb to kill the other, whether it was, whichever faction was in control, and then they would bring those children to the military hospital. So I don't need to motivate them, because they see it every single day. I mean, and when you look at our own news, we have enough problems with gang warfare, racial integration. I mean, we have enough problems between the races with our first responders, but we're desensitized to it. When you see on the news that someone walks up to a police car and shoots the police officer at point-blank range, we don't think about it. We're like, it's part of the ongoing tensions in this country. But when you see it in another country, we label it something different. We say, well, they're targeting us. It's the same problem. So I don't really need to do anything. People come to work and they want to, we all have children. We want to make the world a more peaceful, better place. We don't want to be looking over our shoulder. You know, when I tell kids now and talk about what it used to be like to fly in the airlines and how there was no TSA and you just walked on the airplane and, like, my parents walked me on the airplane and have fun at school and then walked off the airplane, they think I'm making that up. You know, and that's the world that we'll never get back to. So, you know, we're part of a bigger war on idealism about how we think the world should go. So I don't have that problem. I got a lot of great Americans out there who really want to make the world a better place. Plus, we're all privy to a lot more that goes on, other atrocities that don't make the news here just because it's too horrific. Those organizations over there, it is like medieval times of how they enforce standards and judgment, with whether that is beheadings, burning people alive, that kind of torture. So you only need to see a couple of those and you find your inner determination. And what was the last question about?
The last question was about the American that was killed over in Yemen, who had... he was targeted. So he was...
targeting our families.
Son, who was a 19-year-old or so, was with friends. Mm-hmm. They were also targeted and killed.
Right. So, you know, in that respect, you know, if you ever watch any of the propaganda that violent military groups put out, you know, anybody who threatens their way of life is a target. Those were just the ones that were the closest to them. So, you know, when we would travel over in Iraq, you know, we were all targets just by virtue of not being them. Anyone who doesn't support them is a target, even within their own country. I mean, we've got now ISIS and the Taliban fighting each other, and we're like, now what do we do? We're like, which one's worse? Which one's the enemy of my enemy is my friend? You know, one of those kind of things. So, I mean, even in these factions of the world, you know, the same thing happened with the fall of Iraq. Everyone thought if we remove Saddam Hussein that would solve the Iraq problem, but what it did was create a vacuum. When he was there, he was such a dictator. Same thing with other communist countries. A dictator keeps control, and there's only one person in charge. Once they remove the dictator, now all of these other groups came to power, and now there's all this infighting, and it's hard to tell, like, who's going to win or who's going to be triumphant, and it's all the same fight. And it goes, these are no different for the history buffs in the room. These go back to the medieval times. It's just a matter of these are the groups we're fighting now.
Good morning, Colonel. I have two questions. First question, a bill before Congress now that if the draft is ever reinstituted, that women be drafted also. I'd like to get your opinion on that. And the second is, I'm kind of curious. I thought all the carriers had left Pearl before that fateful day.
He might not have been, like, in the actual... No, he was on a ship. Maybe it wasn't a carrier. He was on a ship, though, because he's got some of the pictures from it. But the draft. I don't think we're going to see the draft. They talk about it. We don't have a recruiting problem in the Air Force, and I don't see... or in the military at all. We've downsized so much over the years. We're, you know, half the size of what we were back in the 1980s. If they do a draft for women, I think that on the surface it won't be an issue, but I think that you're going to see a backlash just because of it's not a traditional military field. There's only about 12 to 13% of the military is women, and of that, the higher you get, women tend to, you know, do one or two tours or do their 20 and then go on to other aspirations. You know, still the primary, you know, child bearers in life. You know, most women tend to eventually get out, have children, and do that. So that's why the military keeps women very, very low, 10 to 13%, just because the long term, that's just statistics. And that's not just the military. That's any career field. The more complex a career field gets, the more time-consuming it gets. It becomes harder and harder to juggle family, work-life balance, and we're not different in that respect. What makes ours a little bit more different is that our job takes us away from home. So unlike any other high performance or high job that women do, whether it be medical field, research, education, our job requires me to go somewhere for 6 months at a time. So there's only so many times I'm going to go somewhere for 6 months at a time before eventually I'm going to find a job that keeps me home and with my family. I've been married for since 2003. I do have two kids, but three of my deployments were before I was married. So for me, I didn't do all seven of those deployments with kids. And that's what kind of drives, if you ever look at the senior leader makeup of the Air Force, and they kind of all kind of look the same, mostly men, because the women eventually leave and go have kids. And I think any organization that's high demand on your time.
First of all, thank you very much for your service to our country, and we really appreciate that. One of the things that's a big issue in Central New York is the economic development of Central New York. I'm just curious if you have any statistics or information on the contribution that the MQ-9, is it, makes with the expansion of that, in addition to the economics of the Central New York area.
These are challenging questions. I didn't bring our economic development packet with me. I know that was calculated because now before the base was very small, right? A very small footprint. My group was only about 70 people before this mission. So when you do the math, the difference between 70 and over 300, there's a lot more people coming to this area because of the missions. When you count all the students, look at all the new hotels and food that's around Carrier Circle. That's to support all of that because we don't have that on base. The base and on a guard base, there is no support facilities and infrastructure because you get that from your local community. So we don't have gyms and housing and food because you get that in your community. People go to Wegmans, they go to Tim Hortons or whatever. So the number of jobs did go up when we got the MQ-9 because the mission is a lot larger. We have almost 1,600 people out of the base now. Compared to, say, Niagara Falls, their guard base out there, they're down around between 600-700. So we have a really large base here, and that doesn't count the students. So the students who come in who need to eat, get gas, stay in a hotel, buy stuff, that's a huge economic impact. So I want to say, I'd have to look it up. I don't want to quote the wrong number, but it's a huge number, and it's less about what we do in my group. Well, I shouldn't say that. It's less about the flying than it is about just the number of people we train, because we do all the academic training, all the sim training, all the hands-on training. We do everything for maintenance. Everything is done right there. So it's a large number of people. To go back to his question, in order to not incite people who don't support the military, most of us don't wear our uniforms when we go off base to Wegmans or to grab food, just because you don't want to. We've had enough people get yelled at just trying to get a sandwich at Wegmans by somebody who doesn't support what we do. So we try to minimize that just to improve relations with the base.
Good morning, Colonel. Unless things have changed in the past 50 years, and perhaps they have, the military tends to have leadership on a chain of command. The civilians who are also soldiers don't usually have that in their private lives. And so I was wondering how the two cultures mixed.
The Air Force is the most educated of the four services. So we don't have the problem. Sorry for the Army people in the group. We don't really have a problem with that. So the civilians that are in my organization love coming out to the base. I mean, they love putting the uniform on. They love being a part. It's a camaraderie. You come out there and you're part of one big team. You can kind of leave the other job behind. But like I said, the people who work for me are like firefighters, police officers, the trauma surgeon, a couple teachers. It's a there's a synergy between what they do there and being out at the base. It's not like, you know, anyone's a CEO on the outside and then they come in and they sweep the floor. I mean, there's no, I don't have a huge disparity. Usually whatever you do in the civilian life, you know, you're about commiserate in age and responsibility with what your job is in the military. And most of us have been out. I mean, when you join a unit, you don't usually leave. So, you know, we all kind of grow up together. You see people, they get married, they have kids, they get their degrees, they get promoted. So so we don't have as strict a hierarchy as, say, on active duty, where the turnover is every 2 to 3 years, where that hierarchy is mandated in order to keep the peace and the order. We have a lot of mutual respect for each other because we've all served together for so long. Many of us have deployed together, which creates a cohesive unit when you're all on the ground in Iraq together for a tour. You know, you're a much more cohesive unit when you're all together. So we don't have that problem of people struggling between the come out to work and I'm like, you know, go get your flu shot. Like, I don't have that problem. So.
Good morning, and thank you for your service. I feel the same way. And if you would, I'd like to ask you to speak a little about the way you see or the way you understand your mission. You've mentioned how terrible are the things that individuals or groups are doing to each other in the Middle East. And I would anticipate your answer will have something to do with our mission is to protect America's national security and the people of this country. But the paradox to me seems to be that to the extent that we engage in picking sides in the Middle East and engage in that regional conflict or the multiple conflicts, we invite those combatants to direct their anger at us. The more we are engaged, the more vulnerable we are. I wonder if you would address that.
So what we do in Iraq and Afghanistan is to train those fledgling countries to do this themselves. So the reason we're there is to be side by side with the Iraqis and the Afghanis. I mean, if you were to take those countries and say those countries are where we were back in the Revolutionary War, and look how long it took us to build a formidable military force. We can't look at them and go, okay, hey, we got rid of your dictator, here, go. I mean, they don't have the infrastructure, they don't have the equipment, they don't have the training, and the culture is very different in terms of work ethic, in terms of what you value, in terms of your hierarchy within classes within those countries. So we work hand in hand on all the things that we do. There are guys on the ground, and we're with them. So it's the Iraqis enforcing security in their country to get rid of those organizations that are attacking within Iraq. In Afghanistan, we're hand in hand with them to help them go after that. It's not us exclusively. It's all the countries in NATO. And our role in that, in the MQ-9, is intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, is to get all that information up to the combatant commanders about where is the activity, is it moving, is it leaving those countries, are new factions popping up, and to give all the information, because it does tend to be a little bit of like whack-a-mole. You know, you eradicate the problem in one area, and then they move somewhere where there's more freedom, kind of like the Wild West. And so I think that's why you see the operations moving to places like Yemen, where they'll find a power vacuum somewhere where they have the freedom to maneuver, the freedom to execute some of those more violent training things. And so until those countries can stand on their own, we're helping them train and to do that. So our role in that is to provide all the information to help the mission so that they know where everybody is and what they're doing. And also to, when we do support operations on the ground that are American forces, to make sure that we can prevent attacks and that we can make sure that everything goes safely from our position in the sky. It's no different from the same mission we did in F-16. It's the same exact mission. The only difference is now in the F-16, I had to go to the tanker like every hour and a half to get more gas and then come back. Now we have the persistence ability to stay airborne without having to go back and forth to a tanker. And that is really the only difference. The targeting pod, the mission, everything is the same. The weapons are the same.
I would imagine that I think it's the Air Force mostly in this, that does a very detailed process before they make up their mind to select a spot for particular missions. Why Syracuse is my question. What attracted this to Syracuse? What were its positives?
More of a question for your congressman. And your politicians, so we don't get to decide, right? You know, I'm the worker bee in this organization. But what no elected official wants is to ever close a military installation in your district. So, you know, the military, we're always evolving. There's always new missions. Airplanes are always being retired. So when they saw on the horizon that the F-16 was drawing down, then the generals and the elected officials went to look for, hey, what missions can we bring to the area that are sustainable, that are technological, that take us to the next couple decades, that keep the base open, increase jobs, increase economic development in the area, and that are sustainable. So this mission, you know, we don't deploy anywhere. We stay here and do the mission. And that after two back-to-back trips to Iraq, that was a very, that was something that was, hey, let's stop sending the people themselves into harm's way. What missions can we get from here? Other kinds of 24/7 missions that we have are all of our new cyber units that are working all of the electronics and technology to prevent all the cyber warfare that's going on, as well as all of the intel. You know, just because we see something happen, someone has to analyze it and put it all in a report. It has to go somewhere. So there's units that do that too. So what they did was, as the F-16 was drying down, they looked at all of these emerging mission sets and said, hey, which ones of these should we bring to Syracuse that will tie into the airspace we have, the technology and the resources that we have, that have a lot of jobs, that will work well here. You know, we have a runway. Not every base has a runway. We have a huge training complex in the air. And they said, let's pick up the training missions to this, as well as one combat mission. So we have the relevancy of the entire mission set, from the maintenance training to the air crew training to the combat training. And then everyone cycles through Syracuse, and then we send them to their other guard unit. And there's 13 guard units who do what we do here, and we fly 14 combat air patrols of the nation's 60.
Hi, good Colonel. Very first question, no, my first save is I do have to say that the Army was the first one to require a bachelor's for nurses in 1976, but that's not my question or anything, but I had to say that. My concern or question is going to be about leadership and command. When I went on active duty in the 60s as an Army nurse, we were the only people that we could command were nurses, so we were not allowed to do others, command in any other positions. And then that changed in the late 80s. So I am very proud to hear that you are in a command position, a leadership position. And I have to admit, I think the Air Force has probably been the most progressive in advancing women in leadership command positions. And in your 25-plus years in the Air Force, what changes have you seen for women in the advancement? But remember, one of the issues was always women in combat, and that's still an issue. So what have you seen over your time frame, how women have progressed?
So it's not just women, I would say. It's anything different. So prior to women in combat, it was an issue of race, and we're having the same issue now in terms of gender identity. So it's the same argument all along. You know, you don't know what you don't know. Anything that's different, oh, that can't possibly work. It's going to degrade unit cohesion. It's going to be detrimental to the overall, you know, health and welfare of the organization. When they repealed combat exclusion, for women to fly, not ground combat, which was just recently, that was what was in the news, but the flying part was back in the 90s. But remember, everything we do as pilots is scored. Every ride is scored by criteria. And so everything is constantly ranked. You are ranked on every single thing you do. You have evaluations, you have check rides, you have upgrade rides, you have student rides. So you're constantly ranked against others. So as long as the performance is there, there's really not anything anyone can say to question your ability. And in fighters, it's even more specific because, you know, we go out to the range and we drop practice bombs. Well, they're scored, and they're scored by a computer. So if you beat everyone, then they can't say you don't deserve to have the job. So the best defense is a good offense, and to just go and be the best that you can be. And then now no one can say, well, I don't want to fly with you. I'm like, well, why? I beat you. Are you embarrassed? I'm sorry. Get better. But I say that tongue in cheek, but meaning I still, you know, you're always going to have people who are going to say, my belief system, I don't think so-and-so, I don't want them on my wing when I go into combat. And it's not usually, when you start to talk to somebody, it's not something personal. It usually boiled down to, I'd be flying with someone maybe who was very, very conservative, and they said, if you got shot down and I could not save you, that would be on my conscience forever. And knowing that your kids now don't have a mom, it would be on that. It wouldn't be that I just don't like you because you're a woman. It would be something that didn't fit in with their belief system. Same thing, you know, as the Air Force emerges with where we stand on LGBT, with all the gender identities that are emerging, that's going to be in the same way. People who were gay and lesbian were not allowed to openly serve until very recently for the same reasons. And yet we have everyone in our organizations, and it's not causing a huge demise in unit cohesion and anything else. So part of it is fear, part of it is education. You know, you don't know what you don't know. And then, you know, you're encumbered and you're shackled by the belief system that you grew up. But all the rules are always changing. And so for me, what did I see different? I've always been the only female in every squadron I've been. I've always been the only pilot. And so for me, I almost don't know any different. I'm used to being the only one. And in my group, there are no other female officers out there. I'm the only one. But I've been there for 10 years. So I was there when it was 70, I was the only one. And I'm there and it's, you know, 300, I'm still the only one. And part of it is just who we bring in. I mean, I look at that as more of a go out and say, why don't women join the military? Because it doesn't pay well. Women are smart. And they're going to go and they're going to make more money doing something else, you know. So it takes a very certain amount of patriotism. I joined because of my family history. You know, nobody joins the military to make money and to get rich and the fame. It's not Top Gun. That was the Navy. Every time people say, oh, you joined the Air Force like Top Gun. And I said, yeah, come out to the base. You're not going to see a bunch of shirtless tan guys playing volleyball. I promise you. Not in Syracuse in January. That's does not happen. So I think for me, what I've seen different is when I joined, you know, the numbers are the same, but the focus used to be more on women, and now it is more on the emergence of other gender issues. Whereas before it was women, and then I would have said probably in the 60s and 70s it was on race. So, you know, it's no different. I mean, I don't know. I've never been in an all-male Air Force, so I don't know any different. I just know that the women that we get tend to get more education, tend to move jobs more often, and are more in charge of their careers. And the more I do things like this and talk to other organizations, I realize that that's a very common thread, that women are more flexible and jump around careers and find a way that fits. Whereas, you know, the Air Force, you know, when you're moving every 3 years on active duty and you're married, probably one of you isn't working, or you do something that allows you to stay home because you're moving every 3 years and you're moving from Korea to Japan to Arizona to Germany to Saudi Arabia. You know, if you're married, one of you has to have a job that allows you to do that. So usually you see women are the more flexible and the more malleable. So in my organization, I get young women, they get their degrees, and then they move jobs for whatever degree they got. So our issue is a good problem to have. It's people don't leave the service, they just change jobs once they get their degree.
Good morning, Colonel. I am going to step back to some of your comments earlier to educate me a little bit. You were talking about the equipment, the MK, and MCI? Then a C something. Can you tell me what those are? Educate me a little bit about the equipment.
Oh, the airplanes? Sure. So the KC-10 is a DC-10. So if you've ever flown, you know, on an airliner like United, American, Delta, a DC-10 is a KC-10. All they did was they took the back half and they carved out like the end and they stuck a refueling pod on it, and it has the refueling boom. And in the air, you fly up under it. It connects to a receptacle over the cockpit, and you can take gas in the air. So that's the KC-10. The MQ-9 is what we have at the base. That is a single-engine, remotely piloted aircraft. It's about the size of the F-16 in terms of height, but not as tall and a lot slower. F-16 is obviously a fighter single-engine that we had at the base for about 10 years. The C-12 is a twin-engine. If you've ever flown from like a puddle jumper from like Syracuse to maybe like Boston, or you know, those little twin engine, you know, sitting in the seat like this, and they're one of seat, that's a C-12. So two engines, like one prop on each side, tiny little airplane. We use them for inner theater airlift, so the quickest way to get around Korea, quickest way to get around Europe, rather than launching a big airplane that uses a lot of gas. And then the EA-6 is the A-6 from that the Navy uses. And then they put electronic jammers on it and HARM missiles, anti-radiation missiles. So, sorry, didn't mean to over-technological my speech, but so a little bit of everything. Like I said, you won't find that array of airplanes on anyone's resume. Like, that's, you can't even jump now from heavies to fighters anymore. That's not allowed. So I went through under the old training system where we all flew one airplane in training, and then you graduated, and then they gave assignments. And they've since renovated the training program. So now at the beginning, they decide what you're going to do. And then if you're going to fly heavies, you stay in crew airplanes. And if you're going to fly fighters, you go to single-engine airplanes. So there's no. So now when you graduate, you can no longer cross-pollinate career fields because you didn't have the initial training. I had the initial training because the training system was old. So the training system doesn't know that you're a, what your gender is, or male or female. So as long as you finish number one, two, or three, you're eligible for fighters. So even before the rules changed, I still finished, you know, high enough to get a fighter. I just wasn't allowed to.
On the MQ-9, mm-hmm. How far away can you be to operate? I mean, are you going to operate something in Iraq from Syracuse?
We do. Yeah, we fly our combat air patrols in Afghanistan. So the buildings that are up there, the airplanes are in Afghanistan, and we fly them from here, from a secure facility up here. So there are still crews there that have to take off the airplane, and then once it gets to altitude, we take it over, we fly for them. So we have fresh crews coming in every couple hours, well rested, you know, not getting shot at, who are motivated.
If you're flying Delta, air traffic control will take you from one place mm-hmm. to another place.
Exactly. So there. So and we've been doing the same mission since we stood up Afghanistan, which is either Enduring Freedom or Inherent Resolve are the two. Inherent Resolve is the one I was talking about with the us training the Afghans. So we're providing oversight to them because they don't have the tech. They don't have the military. They're only just buying their first airplanes in their Air Force. So they can't be expected to instantly have a training program that's taken us 40 years to develop and all the technology and computers and, you know, to go with it. So we're helping them.
Good morning. My question takes us in a little different direction. Given your experience in Korea, I'm wondering what your impressions are of risks and threats to us at the moment from North Korea.
North Korea is... you know, that's that old school mindset, you know, old school communism. I think that the biggest threat that they pose is whether or not they have any nuclear technology or their expertise. I know that they do a lot of propaganda, and when we would send people in, they would allow us to talk to their soldiers, and they would say, "Oh, are you here to see our bridge?" And their bridge would be like something going over I-90. And they're like, "It's the biggest bridge in the world." And you're like, "Really?" And they're talking about it, and they're like, "And this is our canning factory, and it's amazing, and we're leading the way," and they're making, like, soup cans. And so it's hard to say when you see, their leaders on the news, how much of that propaganda is believable versus how much is, rhetoric. But, nuclear capability is not something we dismiss. So we have to honor that threat. So we've had, our bases in Korea. If we do all of our exercises there, we train really, really well with the South Koreans. So that's the only threat I see. I don't see this North Korean army going across the river, invading South Korea. I think that's antiquated war has sailed. But I do think that if they have the nuclear capabilities that they say they do, that's our biggest threat. They every so often they'll shoot a missile or they'll shoot across the Sea of Japan just to kind of keep everybody like, hey, we're still here. But they don't have resources, they don't have food, they don't have money. And so it would be a very short engagement if they did engage. But their way of getting financial aid and their way of staying on the radar is to say, hey, look, we shot a missile. See, remember us, we're a threat. So what do? We placate them. And the world gives them money. We give them food. We give them resources. And then they, settle back down again, get through another winter, and then spring comes around again. It always happens in the spring. You can just mark your clock. It's March. You'll either see defectors come across and tell you how they have all this capability and look what they're going to do, or you'll see them start testing missiles, and then the world will get upset, and whoever's coming to power will be like, no, 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 we have to support them. We'll give them a bunch of money. They'll get through the summer, and then it'll die off in the winter because nobody wants to fight a war in the middle of winter. You laugh, but it's true. Nobody wants to go hiking across the peninsula when it's snowing and freezing, especially if you have no food and clothes. So I do think it's a formidable threat. I think all of the communist countries are, but only in the terms of if we don't keep up with the technology and the research and development, we could get past.
Thank you so much, Lieutenant Colonel, for coming and joining us today.